This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's 12:03 on Tuesday afternoon, the 1st of July. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us on the Noon Business Hour. I'm Rob Hart. It is Travel Tuesday on the Noon Business Hour. We'll focus on solo trips for women in our next segment. But right now, as we head into the 4th of July weekend, that means fireworks. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Bruce Zolden, president and CEO of Phantom Fireworks. Works in Youngstown, Ohio, locations across the country. Bruce, thank you for joining us today. Now, a store like yours, do you serve the amateur fireworks showman or showwoman, the person who goes in for just a couple of backyard sparklers, or do you also supply professional fireworks shows?
Well, Rob, thank you for having me. And Phantom Fireworks is primarily a consumer company. We are the largest consumer fireworks retailer in the United States. We also do some professional shows, but our company only does them for charitable organizations or functions. We're not in the display side of the business for a profit, but we are into the consumer side of the business for profit.
And how has business been so far in 2025?
Yeah, business has been real good lately. The month of May, which is our first indicator, was down. I think there was a lot of concerns about the tariffs and were prices higher than they were the previous year, and there were some other economic concerns. But as we got into June, the demand for fireworks started to move upward, and just in the last week or so, it's been a dramatic increase, that even better than the previous year.
And consumer fireworks, almost all of them are imported from China, Bruce. So how has the tariff policy impacted the consumer fireworks space this year?
Well, for this year, I think the American people are fortunate. Most of the products brought into the country were brought in prior to the tariffs being put on. And once the 145% tariff went on, every firework company stopped shipping. So they felt they had enough to get through this season. Our biggest concern, of course, is next year, and next year exceptionally important because of the 250th birthday of America. We have a big concern if the tariffs are still on there. Right now, they're 37.5% for the firework industry, but that's still a lot of percentage to add on. And whether we're eating some of it, the consumer's eating some of it, we hope to be able to get back to where fireworks are exempt completely, because there is no manufacturing of fireworks in the United States.
And of course, that's because fireworks are a Chinese invention. I mean, this goes back thousands of years. And when it comes to fireworks displays next year, regardless of where the tariffs land, you mentioned it's the 250th anniversary of the United States. And as a result of that, is that something where people are just willing to pay any price to celebrate on that one particular day?
Well, I'm sure they're willing to buy fireworks. As you mentioned, the display side of the firework business is also important. And I know cities across the country, jurisdictions across the country, want to double or triple the size of their annual fireworks show. And that's going to be tough for them, too. But for the consumer, I'm sure they have a budget. They have some disposable dollars every year for fireworks. But if the tariffs remain where they're at now, they'll probably get less fireworks for their amount of budget they have.
You might as well say they get less bang for their buck, Bruce.
I hate to say that, yes.
Bruce Zolden, president and CEO of Phantom Fireworks in Youngstown, Ohio. It is America's largest consumer fireworks retailer. And of course, you can hear more from Bruce on the Gaines podcast with our producer, Andy Gersher. He is the guest on the latest edition of Gaines. Find it on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, more women choosing to go it alone on trips. It's Travel Tuesday on the Noon Business Hour.
Money talks as the WBBM BBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Solo travel for women is on the rise. Joining us with tips on how to navigate it all is Angie Rice, co-founder of Boutique Travel Advisors based in Scottsdale, Arizona, the website travelbta.com. Angie, thank you for joining us today. And we have talked about this trend before. And who is the more, how does it shake out demographically, Angie? Is it younger women who are traveling alone, or is this for people who may be retired?
I find it's the bookend. So you're right. It's the younger people that don't have the responsibility of family just yet. And it's also those women that are empty nesters that feel a little bit more liberated to leave home because they're not responsible for children at home. And then you have women who have chosen lifestyles where they don't have children, and they too are common amongst the solo travelers amongst women.
And also the appeal of solo travel is if you're with a group or maybe planning travel for a family, you find yourself in a situation where you're thinking, where you're planning things that will appeal to everybody, just not necessarily you. So it is kind of liberating and exhilarating to plan a trip where you call 100% of the shots.
Yes, and I love being part of the trend and helping redefine what it means to be a woman who travels solo, because you're absolutely right. Solo doesn't necessarily equate to being single, and we do have to really educate others on that concept, because there are women with families that want to experience travel differently. It's their way of transforming and allowing themselves to have their me time and also to focus on the things that they prefer to do. So maybe it's a group of other married women who travel together as a group, because that may be a more comforting environment for the family to allow mom to travel. And then in other cases, we're all together breaking away from those stereotypes that women are not afforded this opportunity to explore the world independently, regardless of their other demographic stats.
And we're talking with Angie Rice, co-founder of Boutique Travel Advisors in Scottsdale, Arizona, about women solo travel for women. And even though we call it solo travel, you're not necessarily by yourself at this destination. As you mentioned, you could be part of a tour group. You could be with friends. And if someone comes up to you and they want to start planning this vacation, what are some of the things that you want to keep in mind as you're putting this trip together?
Correct. There's a lot of organizations out there that are wanting to help support women with opportunities to travel and build community. So I would check with the resources already available to you, whether it's your church, your synagogue, maybe it's your child's school. That's oftentimes I see high school graduates, those moms. And also travel agencies, like Boutique Travel Advisors. We have a couple of solo travelers, that is their niche. So they plan two or three groups of women to travel together. We have one coming up relatively soon to Egypt, and we have more trips to Morocco as well. So just getting in someone's database so that if they do launch a trip in the upcoming future, you're notified of it and you can start to build a sense of community. I also recommend joining social forums, whether it's a Facebook group, where you can get to know other women, whether you travel with them or whether you're just utilizing them to learn and to feel like you're in a supportive environment.
You mentioned Egypt and Morocco. What are some of the top destinations for women who are traveling solo or in a solo travelers group?
Those two destinations rank high. I'd also add Patagonia to the mix. We're seeing a trend where women want to explore expedition destinations. So cruising on an expedition ship is also very popular. And again, naturally, I see most women who want to travel more independently tend to be an adventurous type person, someone who likes to hike. So we do a lot of tour groups with Backroads as well as with our independent destination specialists to incorporate a lot of adventure travel when women travel. They're busy, and so they like to stay active.
Angie Rice, co-founder of Boutique Travel Advisors in Scottsdale, Arizona. Find her online, travelbta.com. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, as we hit the halfway point of the year, you may want to review your plans for charitable giving.
It's the only program dedicated to currency events. You're listening to the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
Charities need support all year and not just during the holidays. The demand is constant. Joining us to discuss how you can help throughout the year is Michael Michael Thatcher, CEO of CharityNavigator.org in Saddlebrook, New Jersey. Michael, thank you for joining us today. And this is actually a great time to talk about charitable giving on this first day of the third quarter. And also, happy first day of the third quarter to you, Michael. But we talk about charitable giving at the end of the year as part of everybody is soliciting for donations when the holidays roll around. It's a different situation in July. So what are some things to keep in mind if you are thinking about giving to a charity right now as opposed to the end of the year?
Thanks, Rob. I think the at the end of the day, it really, what are the things that you care about? And if you really care about them, realize that this is a fallow period for many nonprofits, and they're not necessarily getting that steady stream of revenue as they would be, you know, if they nonprofits get a significant portion, really big portion of their annual revenue in the month of December, pretty much from Thanksgiving through the end of the year. That they're going to need your help right now. And I think one of the things that we found that really helps nonprofits, doesn't matter what kind of organization you're seeking to support, is to sign up for a monthly withdrawal from your credit card. So rather than make that one big gift in December, you could make 12 little gifts that add up to the same amount, and that gives them sustainable revenue. If you have a little extra at the end of the year, you can always add some more at the end of the year. They love that.
And then when it comes to assessing which charities actually devote their donations to helping people as opposed to administrative costs, what are some of the features that Charity Navigator brings to the table so you know that your donation is actually helping the cause that is near and dear to your heart?
That's a great question. And I think one of the things we try and do at CharityNavigator.org is really make that giving process and selection easier for you. We're looking at four key areas in how we assess an organization. At the end of the day, you'll see a star rating. It'll be a 0 to 4 star ratings. 4 stars are the best. We're looking at the impact the organization is making. We're looking at their leadership. We're looking at their finances. And we're also looking at sort of the way they connect in with the communities that they're serving. We try and make this really easy to read through. You can search on any legally registered charity in the United States. You'll find it on our database. And we've got ratings on about 240,000 of them with detailed information on how to make a difference in the causes that you care about.
Michael Thatcher, CEO of CharityNavigator.org in Saddlebrook, New Jersey. Thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour. Still ahead in Travel Tuesday, a look at nostalgia-inspired road trips.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon, I'm Rob Hart. Markets are mixed this afternoon. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Sam Stovall, Chief Investment Strategist, CFRA Research in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Sam, thank you for joining us today. And before we talk about today's market activity and what could come in the second half of the year, let's wrap up the first half of 2025. Today is the first day of the third quarter, and your assessment of market activity in what has been a rather turbulent first half of the year.
Hello, Rob. Well, I think we traced out a V-shaped movement in the overall market, declining nearly 20% from February 19th through April 8th. But through the 27th, we actually recovered everything we lost and then added some in the final trading day on June 30th. So as a result, the S&P was up 5.5% for the entire first half. We also saw 8 of the 11 sectors in positive territory, led by communication services and industrials, and also 60% of the industries. So amazingly, the market shrugged off the worries and worked its way to a new all-time high.
It does seem like, looking at market activity over the first half of the year, that investors always gravitated towards good news or the sunny side of the street, regardless of what was happening.
Well, there was a worry at the time because of the tariffs that it could bring on a recession. And bull markets don't die of old age, they die of fright. And what they're most afraid of is recession. But once we got the feeling that no, recession was not in the cards, then that's what really triggered the market to work its way higher.
Now, when it comes to the president's tax and spending bill just passed by the Senate, so it's essentially on the goal line. They're lining up to punch it through to the end zone, to use a very tortured football analogy this afternoon, Sam. But chances are this thing is going to pass more or less in the form that it's at now. What's the analysis and how this will impact the economy, both on the tax cut side, but also on the spending cut side and on the budget deficit side?
Well, it seems, first off, bad news first, that it might end up adding to the overall deficit by $4 trillion. As a result, we're actually seeing the yield on the 10-year note rise ever so slightly. It's now at 4.25%. And I think that investors will have to really scour the data to decide whether it would likely end up being inflationary. Fed Chair Powell also said today that the Fed would have cut rates already if it were not for the tariffs. So because of the bill, because of the tariffs, I think investors have to wait and see what the Fed will actually do.
Over the years, whenever there is a big tax cut bill or whenever there is a big spending bill that makes its way through Washington, the deficit hawks are always they're captain bring down. They're the ones who want everybody to understand that this party does indeed have a price tag to it. But the warning about deficits and the national debt being unsustainable, that has been sounded for many, many, many years now. And people have been able to shrug it off because the bill has never come due during their lifetime. But what are some of the long-term effects of, you know, sustained budget deficits and continuing to pile on the national debt?
Well, as we have already seen, we are now paying more in interest than we are spending on national defense. And that is a fairly new phenomena. So the more debt that we pile on when interest rates do rise, because at 4.25%, that's below the long-term average 5.5% on the 10-year note. And so as a result, we could end up paying even more just to service that debt. And whatever money goes to servicing the debt could have been used to help the overall economy. So it could end up acting like an anchor to slow economic growth.
And then very quickly, looking ahead to interest rate activity in the second half of the year, you mentioned how Chairman Powell said under different circumstances, we would have had an interest rate cut already. Even though he did, if you read between the lines, or maybe it's a charitable reading between the lines, he didn't necessarily rule out the possibility of a rate cut in July.
You're absolutely right. And I think that while we will get one cut in the third quarter and another cut in the fourth quarter, our initial estimate was for that cut occurring in September. But yes, it may actually indeed occur in July.
Sam Stovall, Chief Investment Strategist, CFRA Research in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next in Travel Tuesday, we will talk about the rise of retro road trips and all those kitschy roadside attractions.
Because money matters. This is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's Travel Tuesday and retro road trips are back. Travelers are hitting the road for kitschy motels, vintage diners, and quirky roadside attractions in search of nostalgia and Americana charm. We welcome in Mark Wolters, Wolters World Travel and Culture. Find him on YouTube, an associate professor of business administration at the University of Illinois Geese College of Business in Urbana-Champaign. Mark, thank you for joining us today. And normally, when you come on the show, Mark, we talk about how you can dine like a local on the streets of Rome, how you can blend in effortlessly in Brussels. But today, we're going to talk about the world's largest ball of twine, or possibly a very kitschy motel on Route 66, or just some kind of fun place to stop and stretch your legs on Interstate 80 somewhere in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, you can do so many things, and so many families now are really taking the opportunity to kind of relive the glory days and the nostalgia of Route 66 and other road trips, whether you're taking the Great River Road. There's so many opportunities for people, and yes, you can get up to Darwin, Minnesota to see the world's largest ball of twine, Rob, so you've done your research, my friend.
Now, I feel like this is something, and there's a larger trend I see on social media, and this kind of ties into the affordability issues that a lot of people are encountering today, especially younger people as they step into the professional world, and then they finally realize, oh, wait a minute, all this stuff I was used to as a kid actually costs money, and I may not necessarily be able to afford all of those things. And it leads people into a sense of false nostalgia, and that maybe economic circumstances were different many decades ago, and that a family on a single income could afford the life that you were used to. But the reality is, if you were growing up in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, or even the 80s, if you wanted to have that blowout family vacation, it wasn't Disney World, it wasn't Europe, it was a road trip to the lake. And maybe you did sleep at the motel, and you were riding in the back of the family station wagon. So everything that's old is new again.
Yeah, and people don't remember all those motels we used to stay at in the 70s and 80s that, you know, nowadays you'd never even think about staying at. But now you're like, wait a minute, we stayed there all the time. And you can actually go and enjoy those. And a lot of them have been kind of updated to be more in the state of the people looking for today. So you can go back to some of those nostalgic places and have kind of an updated version of it. But the economic side of it is true, like that the retro road trip is a much more affordable option for a lot of families. So they can go and see the places, whether going to, you know, up to the Dells, they're going out to the Lake of the Ozarks, you know, going to the Upper Peninsula, you can do those things. And that's one of the nice things about it. And when you're going on those things, you can find the free things, seeing those silly sites like the largest ball of twine, or going to Casey, Illinois, and seeing like eight, I think they have seven or eight Guinness World Records for the largest like rocking chair and golf tee and stuff. So it really drives people to go see it, especially if they want to get their Instagram pictures, which drives a lot of this too.
And it's interesting if people are rediscovering road trips after maybe a lifetime of flying to various destinations, and you want to unleash your inner Clark Griswold as you point the family truckster west, what is a good way to begin planning that trip so you can see all of those sites along the way, and maybe, you know, not, do it in a way where you're not on interstate highways the entire time?
Well, one thing I would say is first have that end destination point, and then when you have that, think about a loop. Think of a circle so you're not retracing the same destination, because you could go out via North Dakota to go out and see Yosemite and go and see that and then come back around, or Yellowstone and come back around through South Dakota, or come through Nebraska and see some more kitsch stuff. And that's where I think a lot of people, they kind of get this idea, I got to get from point A to point B, and they don't think about all the things in between. So when you do that, Google and a lot of the other websites will help you find like silly roadside attractions on the way. So you don't just sit in the car for 8 hours. You can do the 8-hour drive, but maybe you stop for an hour in, you know, South Dakota and go to, you know, the Corn Palace, you know, or maybe you go to Wall Drug and Wall, you know, South Dakota to see all the kitschy stuff there. So it makes it a nice break, and you can see things along the way.
Now, this is something where my wife and I have very different philosophies of travel, because she grew up with road trips throughout the state of Iowa, and her father was a firm believer in you never take the highways, you always take the back roads, you always go to the diner and try the signature dessert. Meanwhile, my proudest accomplishment, Mark, was driving directly from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan back to Chicago in 6 hours without stopping. So that was my kind of belief on road trips. I have been slowly brought around to stopping to see the sights along the way. And I always joke, we see so many sights along the way on a road trip. No matter where we're going, we get there at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's the thing is, you'll see there's organizations now that'll help you. I mean, if you like tenderloins, there's actually the Tenderloin Trail that goes through Indiana and Illinois, where you literally can just find the best tenderloins on the way. I mean, it's hilarious how that can happen. Or like if you're on Route 66, those old diners and restaurants, like I go to Taylor's Chili in Carlinville, Illinois on Route 66 just to have their chili when I go there, because it's one of those things. Or if you go to Cozy Dog and have their Cozy Dogs like a corn dog in Springfield. I mean, you have these options and you find those. It's kind of a fun thing, especially if you bring your kids along and you kind of get a little bit of Americana for them to kind of take in.
And if you want to dip your toe in the water and you're not an experienced road trip person, just try Southwest Michigan. Just go to Holland one day or for one weekend, but take the Dunes Highway through Northwest Indiana, and a lot of those old-timey roadside attractions I've discovered are still there, and they're only an hour away.
Oh, yeah. And that's the thing is you just take advantage of it because sometimes we forget there's these things that are so close because we think so far for our vacation. We don't realize sometimes you can just do a weekend day trip and kind of take it all in.
Mark Walter is Walter's World Travel and Culture. Find him on YouTube, but also an associate professor of business administration at the University of Illinois Geese College of Business at Urbana-Champaign. Join us at this time tomorrow for Personal Finance Wednesday. And still to come, the latest report on car sales is driven by economic uncertainty and concern about tariffs.
This is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
Car sales have plunged following a spring surge. Joining us to help analyze the changing market is John McElroy, automotive industry analyst and host of Autoline.tv in Detroit. John, thank you for joining us today. And is this another case of people pulling their purchases forward to get ahead of tariffs?
Yeah, no, that's a huge part of what's going on here, Rob. You know, when people heard that tariffs were going to raise prices of cars, a lot of people who were sitting on the sidelines deciding when to buy ran out and bought a new car. It's what the industry calls pull forward. It pulled those sales forward than they normally would have happened. Now we're starting to see sales slow down. It depends on the automaker. Some are up, but a number are down. I think July, though, is when we're really going to start to see a drop off in sales.
Anecdotally speaking, from people who are trying to buy cars and get ahead of the tariffs potentially earlier in the spring, they noticed that for some makes and models, that inventory was very difficult to come by. If you wanted to test drive a car, one wasn't available. How is that going to change in the second half of the year?
Oh, it's only going to get worse. I mean, look, automakers knew that the tariffs were coming. Any cars that they import, they rush them forward. They try to bring in as many, same with components for suppliers, before those prices went up. Well, they're running out of that inventory right now. And everything that's left is going to be a higher price, whether, you know, maybe they don't raise the prices, but they're going to take the incentives away. So you're going to see tighter inventory, both new and used, and you're going to see higher prices for both of them, too.
Now, does this mean if you are in the market for a new car or you have to get a new car in the second half of the year, does this mean the party's over for you potentially?
Oh, the party's over. The party's been over since about March. And like I said, it's likely that supplies are only going to get tighter as the year goes on because of the tariffs, limiting what number of cars can be in here. Automakers are trying to move more production to the U.S., that's going to take years to happen. So right now, tighter inventory, higher prices, both new and used.
And then when it comes to how will the dealers respond? Because obviously, if they have tighter inventory, then they have less of an incentive to make things easier on you. But if sales do slow down to a trickle, what can they do to bring people back?
It's going to be the same thing that we saw during COVID. Dealers are going to make a lot of money, even though they'll be selling fewer vehicles. They're going to be selling at higher prices. And so net of everything, dealers will look good. I think the automakers will look good, but automotive suppliers and consumers who want to buy cars, they're the ones that are going to be caught in a tough place.
John McElroy, automotive industry analyst and host of Autoline.tv in Detroit. Thank you for joining us today. If you missed any part of today's show, just go to our stream and skip back to the time you want. There's a pause and rewind function that works both online and with the Odyssey app.